Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we're releasing a special episode from a project that I undertook in 2022 called the Boundless Body Radio Premium Podcast. My intention was to take all of the best clips about one particular topic and put them together as a masterclass to be released behind a paywall with a subscription-based service on Patreon. Well, we didn't have many subscribers, so I'm breaking up these episodes and releasing them here for free so that they can make an impact and hopefully help some people out there. Today's episode was taken from the second series, all about ketosis and the ketogenic diet. This is part two from the first episode, again, all about keto and the ketogenic diet. We always appreciate feedback you may have, so please feel free to leave us a comment on YouTube or go to our website at myboundlessbody.com, where, as always, you can book a complimentary 30-minute session with us at any time so that we can get to know you and discuss your fitness goals and help you make a plan. Cheers and enjoy part two of this two-part conversation all about the ketogenic diet. We've already mentioned cancer, and we talked quite a bit about cancer last time, but just to reiterate, how beneficial are ketones in the cancer treatment world, and what have we learned even more recently about that?
It's still an ongoing thing, Casey. And, you know, what's frustrating is the clinical trials are so hard to do because there's no money to be made. You know, there's no patentable drug, so you got to rely on foundations or when the NIH is feeling sort of philanthropic, but it's when you look at what happens. So cancer cell has an insatiable appetite for glucose. We know that. That's what a PET scan is. A PET scan is radiolabeled glucose, and you can visualize tumors that way. You inject somebody with radiolabeled glucose, and the tumor cells preferentially take it up and trap it in the cell. So the idea behind the ketogenic diet is you bring down blood glucose, you replace it with a ketone body, which has to be burned in the mitochondria. And we know that cancer cells have impaired mitochondrial function. Whether it's intentional by the cancer cell or it's damaged, that's still an ongoing debate. But we know that. They don't like to burn ketones as much. So what you get is you get this rarely happens in pharmacology, this beautiful therapeutic differential where healthy cells have switched over to burning ketones, which causes them to go into this regenerative, reparative state. They become very robust to insult, right? And then the cancer cells are struggling because they're not getting enough energy to fuel all their growth, and especially to mop up free radicals. They're always on this very precarious edge of dying from oxidative stress. And that's what radiation and chemo is oxidative stress. So you set them up. You set up the cancer cells to die easier and healthy cells to go through insult more. So when you have somebody in that state and then you give them chemotherapy or radiation, you see a more dramatic effect. You see a more therapeutic effect, but you also see a huge reduction in side effects. So when someone's on chemo, you can measure number of times they vomit. That can go from 7 a day, literally to 0 when someone's in a fasted Wow. ketogenic state. Hair growth, mouth sores, all the things you can count go down. And the subjective things like fatigue and things like that. So I think that's where it's got a real potential is just, you know, I envision in the future, there'll be three branches of oncology. There'll be radiation, medical oncology, which is chemo and drugs, and metabolic. And so you'll have somebody put people in this state before they get standard of care. And it's moving in that direction. They're noticing all kinds of drugs work better on the ketogenic diet, you know, at major cancer institutions. We're trying to fund a trial, the ketogenic diet on glioblastoma alongside standard care at Cedars-Sinai. So I think within, you know, if you have me on again in 5 years, I think it'll be a much different landscape.
I really hope so. I really, really hope so. Yeah. I mean, incurable, which we're going to talk about here in a second, but incurable, you make the case that like we're diagnosing more cancer now, but we're not changing the survival rates. Like what is going on with that? And you know, I asked you this question. I love asking people who do the research this question. What would you do if somebody gave you the diagnosis, knowing everything you know, what would you do? And most of us can sit around and we can theorize what we might do, but we don't actually maybe know what we would choose in that state. We've hosted Martha Tettenborn on our show who was given a cancer diagnosis, and she was a registered nurse and she did the research herself. And so she learned that if she was on mostly like very strict keto during the procedure, and then when they traveled to, I want to say Toronto to get the treatments done, she would do 48 hours fasted before the treatment, 24 hours after, full fast. She was a little tired. She never got sick. She was fully functional. She made all her meals. Like, talk about somebody who like really had to put their money where their mouth was, and she did great. And now she's sharing that message along, you know, so many other people that are trying this themselves that, yeah, nobody's talking about this because nobody's going to make money on a trial. But you can do this easily for free. And whether it's going to, you know, work with cancer and you don't have to do other treatments is kind of controversial, but at least it will be helpful.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would do a number of those things. And I always have to preface that with, you know, every case is individual. So if somebody wanted to fast before chemo, they would need to have a medical workup, because if they're late stages of cachexia, you know, they may not be able to lose weight. It may be detrimental. So always work with other people. But yeah, for me, when you look at medicine, it's always done through the lens of risk reward. So I look at a ketogenic diet as extraordinarily low risk, and that's already been proven. It's very safe in a cancer setting and with health people that are, you know, in a decent functional state. And so why not? Why wouldn't you do that? I would look at all, you know, the repurposed drugs that we know are safe that have anti-cancer activity, combinations of those. There's some nutraceuticals that have incredible early data, like luteolin, apigenin, those kind of things. I couldn't imagine, you know, I think doctors probably do, when it happens to them, way more than they would recommend to patients under most settings. So I look at from that end of risk reward, I would just do all the combinations of all those things I could. Yeah, why not? It also, when you think of the cancer problem, it always leads you to, well, how do you not get cancer in the first place, right? How do you prevent it from happening? And that's where I think a ketogenic diet could, or fat, intermittent fasting, whatever, you know, is proven to work, could have a huge role to play. Because one of the most astounding aspects of being in ketosis is you get this dramatic ability to antioxidant effect. So we get an upregulation of all these enzymes that quench free radicals like superoxide dismutase, catalase, but you also get this huge increase in glutathione, the ability of glutathione to mop up free radicals. Free radicals, we know, break DNA. DNA can trigger cancer, whether it's, usually it's not the genetic mutation itself, it can be, it's a combination of mutations, but that triggers a whole series of other epigenetic things that can lead to cancer. And ketosis prevents free radicals, which prevents DNA breaks. So you know, that may be one way to just not get cancer in the first, or at least reduce the probability of getting cancer in the first place.
Sure. Or make it move slower so that it, yeah, maybe you do have cancer, but it's not going to advance before you're going to pass away of natural causes anyway. It's so interesting. There's just so many benefits on so many levels. It's like, we look at it as like, you're going to go on the ketogenic diet or be in ketosis, but it really seems more like, no, we have a real lack of ketosis in our natural lives because of all the crap that we've set up for ourselves.
Yeah, I couldn't agree. That line in the New York Times article that Gary Taubes wrote, I think in 2004, 2006, maybe, Richard Veitch was quoted as saying, the natural state of mankind is to starve occasionally. And that's a huge question. What, have we stepped that far out of our natural physiology that we're way more sickly than we should be, right? Should we have cancer rates like this? Because we don't see those in the wild with animals. So we've stepped out of this biological niche that is conducive to good health into this new era. You know, that probably happened about 12,000 years ago with modern agriculture, when we just drastically shifted our diet.
Yeah.
And then became very indolent, you know, desk jobs, we solved energy problems, we didn't have to chop wood anymore. So it's a sort of collision of lifestyle events that led us to this, what I would call an unnatural state. And yeah, I think when you look at the benefits of ketosis so far in the literature, from neurodegeneration to diabetes to, you know, you just go down to almost every chronic disease, right? That's the biggest burden in the healthcare system. So yeah, it begs the question is, how can something be that beneficial if it's not something that's evolutionarily baked in to be this therapeutic effect?
Yeah. Great point. It's so ironic that technology is what makes us human. You know, banging two rocks together to make a tool makes us human, yet that same technology comes back to bite us in the ass, you know, 12,000 years ago with agriculture and everything.
Solve one problem and create another.
That's right.
We're good at that.
So that was Travis Christofferson, taken from episode 306 of Boundless Body Radio. And he mentions Dr. Thomas Seyfried. And I do want to include a clip of the interview that we did with him. This will be very short. This is back from episode 60 of Boundless Body Radio with Dr. Thomas Seyfried. I so much appreciate this guy's work and everything that he's doing. If you have more interest in this, please go back and listen to those episodes we've done with him. This is a very personal topic for me, as I basically had a front row seat to watching my mom pass away from cancer over a 7.5 year period. And it was absolutely just brutal to see what these treatments were doing to her. Obviously the treatments have gotten better in that time, but I clearly remember back in, it was the late 90s when she was diagnosed with breast cancer, we decided to do everything more healthy as a family. And we really switched things out so that we could, you know, help support my mom and help support her treatment. So we went on to a low fat, higher carbohydrate diet because that was kind of the thing to do. And knowing this research today and knowing what we know about cancer and carbohydrates and sugar, and also the ketogenic diet and how that can be applied to cancer treatments, just absolutely makes me wish I could go back and help my mom out in a different way. Obviously, we were just doing the best that we could at the time. And the whole message back then was, you know, anti-fat, and the fat was going to kill you and at least, you know, give you a heart attack. And so I remember going to the hospital and bringing my mom things like the Starbucks, I don't know, like apple kind of cider stuff that they would sell. And they would just pump it full of like cream and additional sugar. And it was her favorite little treat to get while she was getting cancer treatments. And I just think, you know, again, knowing this information and learning what we've learned about cancer, what a mistake that was, and how, again, I wish I could go back and eliminate all sugar and carbohydrates from the diet, knowing what we know now. So let's listen in to Dr. Thomas Seyfried and his interesting research on cancer as a metabolic disease.
When you do ketogenic metabolic therapy, you know, we published the glucose ketone index calculator, which allows everybody to know whether they're the degree of therapeutic ketosis that they're in. So when the ratio of ketone bodies and in the blood and glucose in the blood is a 1-to-1, a 1.0 or below, that means ketones are higher than glucose. I mean, you're gonna rain hell down on that tumor cell, those tumors in your body. So so that's the biomarker for cancer patients to know whether they're in therapeutic ketosis. Once they're in therapeutic ketosis, then we come in with drugs and procedures that will degrade slowly the tumor. And many people emerge from this in a healthier state, far healthier than they were when they started.
Interesting. So that was going to be my question on the case study. Like if we're buying some people, you know, 70-ish more days, you know, we talk about, you know, a lifespan and an expanded lifespan, but who cares if your health span is not great? Like what's this guy's experience in life? Is he suffering, not a great life experience? Like what is his life like?
Yeah, his life is quite good. I mean, he does have breakthrough seizures from the surgery and things, like a lot of anybody who would have brain surgery. Many people with brain surgery, regardless of what kind of brain surgery you might have. And he had the tumor debulked 3 years after he was diagnosed. So he did have it taken out, but it was 3 years, not immediately. He has some seizures, but his quality of life is great. I mean, he got married as a child. He's living a life that is not so debilitating, okay? It's not like he's suffering. Of course, like some people would say, well, if I have to keep myself in ketosis, he's adapted his body to this. And I've spoken to him, you know, and I met him and I talked to him. And he's happy. He has a little baby. He's doing, I mean, he's not going to go out to the bar and pound big beers and things like this. But you know, because he's enjoying his life. He's not suffering like you would see. You know, there was no vomiting, you know, diet. And this is another amazing thing. You know, when you get these chemotherapies or immunotherapies and all these kinds of things, your body gets like beat up. Not all people. I don't want to say everybody who gets an immunotherapy is going to be sick as a dog. But, you know, if you hear the notes on TV every night, Opdivo, your Keytruda, your all these different names they have for these things. You can have this side of it. It can kill you. Listen, the metabolic therapy will never kill anybody as far as I can see. But those other therapies could possibly kill you or make you massively sick, like you mentioned at the beginning of this interview. Mm. You have seen the effects of what these things do. I have seen it. People come to me and they say, oh, can you help me? I went through the whole system. My cancer's still growing. They look like death warmed over, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if metabolic therapy can rescue people within a few weeks of their life. I mean, you can, you remember Tammy Faye Baker, you can go on the web and you can look at pictures of her when she was, you know, healthy. And then at the very end, I mean, she was, you know, horrifically beat up by the system, by the cancer and the treatments. I mean, you know, people know what you look like when you get at the end from being poisoned and irradiated. I mean, your body is just, why you take a sick person and you subject them to such toxic therapy when you don't have to do that? I mean, why are you doing radiation and chemo in the first place? Well, we got to stop the proliferating cells. Well, yeah, but if they don't have energy, they're not going to grow. They're going to up and die. So you just pull the plug on their energy and they'll die just as fine. And you keep the rest of the body healthy. So why are you doing what you're doing?
Wow.
And these are the big questions. And you go to any oncology group anywhere, you're at Utah, right? Go down to the medical school at the University of Utah and say, yeah, you guys do metabolic therapy. They're going to say, what's that? You know, and most of them are not even going to know about it. Well, you say, why? Well, don't they read the scientific literature? Well, there's no clinical trial. They always throw like rather than say, if the pharmaceutical company came along with what we can do with metabolic therapy, it'd be a worldwide joy as the result of this. But, you know, it's just, we're just not there yet. Not enough people know about it.
Wow.
And even the medical establishment doesn't even know about it.
And it's like you mentioned, like, and what if it doesn't work, but like just the benefits of being in ketosis on a ketogenic diet? Like, why would you not want to drop your blood pressure or lose some weight or, you know, improve your insulin sensitivity?
Like, well, because people have faith in the medical system and they should. I mean, some parts of the medical field have made massive advances, like in knee replacements, hip replacements, heart disease, valve replacements. I mean, there have been miraculous advances, but the cancer is still in the Stone Age, you know, and it's going to overtake heart disease in the next couple of years. So if it hasn't already, in China, it's already, there's 8,100 people a day dying in China from cancer. They have, obviously, they have a much larger population of people, but it's the number one killer of people in China is cancer. And you say to yourself, why have we made all these other advances in medicine, like you alluded to at the beginning of the interview, but yet cancer is still wallowing in a lack of knowledge and, you know, in procedures that harm you as much as they could possibly help you. I mean, it's just because you have a misunderstanding of the origin of the disease. It's a mitochondrial metabolic disease. It's not a genetic disease. Okay. And that's the key. So if you don't understand the origin of the disease and you build therapies based on something that's not the origin, you're going to get drugs and therapies that do not work effectively, period.
So at this point in the conversation, I think you are wrapping your brain around the uses for a ketogenic diet and hoping that you're realizing at this time that this is definitely not a fad diet. And it's amazing that people can lose weight on this, but this is a diet that is actually healing and helping people. And nobody knows that better than Jen Winkler, who's known as the ketogenic mom on social media. She has a personal story with epilepsy, which is how the ketogenic diet was really first developed about 100 years ago to treat kids with epilepsy. And she talks about how effective it was at the time, but because we developed medicines that did not work nearly as well, but were something that we could prescribe and sell to people, that people stopped using a ketogenic diet as a primary treatment and started to shift the research over to pharmaceuticals, which was absolutely a mistake. And it's really wonderful now that things like the Charlie Foundation are doing such great work about bringing this message back to the forefront that you can use a ketogenic diet to help with epilepsy. Jen has that personal story, so let's go hear her now. For somebody who doesn't really know, kind of a brief history about like epilepsy and epilepsy treatments. I think more people now kind of, you know, tie those two things together and like, yeah, epilepsy can be connected to ketogenic and more people recognize that. But this isn't new. This isn't something somebody figured out like 5-10 years ago. Can you talk a little bit about how we originally were treating this?
Yeah. So in the early 1900s was when they had discovered the ketogenic diet or therapeutic ketogenic diet for children with epilepsy. So they were having kids having seizures. The way they would treat the children was put them in their hospital, and they would make them fast. I believe it was about 48 hours to get the ketones going. So they couldn't eat. It was 24 to 48, somewhere in there. They would make them fast so that the ketones get built up in the body and start healing the brain. And what I'm assuming is the gut as well, because as most people know, there's a deep connection with our gut and our brain. They consider our gut our second brain. So they would start the fast, and then they would start the ketogenic diet on the children, where it would be a very high fat. I think typically back then it was about an 80% of the calories was fat, and then 20% was protein and carbs. So pretty much almost always the children stopped having seizures. They didn't have to stay ketogenic, but back then it was kind of like, there wasn't processed foods back then. It was just their basic foods. There were maybe a few little things here and there, but nothing like what we have today. So they were still pretty healthy. They were having their veggies and their, you know, maybe a toast with breakfast or something like that. As time evolved, pharmaceuticals came into the picture, and they developed the first medication for anti-epilepsy medication. And then when there was another one, they said, why do we need to force kids to eat what I would call a healthy diet, but they call it ketogenic? Why force them to eat a different way when they can just pop a pill? And that has really become the mentality of not just epilepsy, but of many things these days, of heart disease, of blood pressure, of diabetes. Let's just stick ourselves with insulin every single time, you know? So that's where that started. And now there's a plethora of different medications that they will give adults and children alike. It's very rare that they will try ketogenic first. Johns Hopkins Hospital has done a lot of research with this. They now actually, I think for about 12 or 13 years, have had a whole section dedicated for ketogenic for adults now. And people can fly there. They can have, you know, training on how to do it for themselves, because it is very different. You can put a child in a hospital for a week, 2 weeks. It's very easy for that to happen. An adult, not so much. So there's lots of research with it. And Johns Hopkins has about 7 editions now on their ketogenic and modified Atkins book. And this last one has tons of stuff to show the evidence of how it can treat Alzheimer's, autism, ADHD, Parkinson's, pretty much almost any neurological disease. But yeah, if you really dig hard in the epilepsy world a bit, they typically say they will try one medication. If the medication doesn't work, try a new medication. If that medication doesn't work, try a dual medication, so having two medications, which is where I was at. And if that doesn't work, you just keep adding at that point. What it's supposed to be, and some places will do, is after the dual one, then they try the diet. Then they try the ketogenic. Really, it should be like the opposite. Try the diet first instead of infiltrating the body with so much foreign substance. But yeah, they didn't even approach it that way to me. I had to be the one to be my own advocate and try the diet.
So speaking of ineffective pharmaceuticals, let's go back to Nicole Laurent and let's ask her about pharmaceuticals and drugs and the difference between that and using a ketogenic diet. She does get pretty passionate here. And this is another really important topic and a very important area of research. What are ketones doing in the brain? And can we use them to help people that are having traumatic brain injuries or are suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's? And the results so far with the research are very promising. So let's go listen to Nicole Laurent for the second time. If there was a medication that did what this diet could do, completely, you know, change the industry?
Oh my gosh. We don't have medications that do what the ketogenic diet does, period. We have medications that try to zero in on one specific thing, but I want to make more serotonin, I want someone to have more serotonin available in their synaptic cleft of their neurons so that it can do its effects longer, right? So we'll do things like that. And there's been like dopamine reuptake stuff and norepinephrine. And so we just keep trying to come at it with those types of things. And it's so inadequate. Like, can we just stop talking about psychopharmacology as though it has saved everyone, because it has not. I am sorry. Taking a lot. I mean, like, if you like your medication, that is fine. I am happy for you. I am happy you are alive because of it. I am happy that you are functioning at a level that you feel is okay because of it. I am joyous that you are doing well if you are on psychotropic medication. But we need to really acknowledge the fact that there are millions of people on psychotropic medications because it is the standard of care that are not well. They are emotionally flat. They are having sexual side effects. They don't feel good. The medications are not working well. They have a lot of prodromal symptoms. You know, like someone with bipolar, you know, great. I'm lithium's fantastic. Or, you know, however they keep the mania down, but they're still suffering with a lot of the depressive symptoms because we don't have psychopharm that works really well for that for people. And when people are on psychopharmacology, often, and anyone who's been on this knows, they're like, oh, it works pretty well for a few weeks. And then there's some kind of adaptation that happens. And then people are getting medications for the side effects from the medications. And we have to talk about what those medications do. I mean, we haven't talked about micronutrients yet and how they're needed to do things like make serotonin in the first place. But we're also not talking about, you know, the nutrient depletion that happens as a result of being on medications. And one of the worst offenders of nutrient depletion are, you know, psychotropic medications. You know, antipsychotic medications deplete nutrients terribly. ADHD medication stimulants deplete nutrients terribly. There's lots of other medications that many of us go on right away, like, you know, hormonal birth control, a lot of the ladies, you know, and then they start getting other symptoms with their mood. A lot of that might not be hormones. It might just be straight up micronutrient depletion because the doctors do not supplement the micronutrients that they know are being depleted, that it's being documented in the literature because of the huge disconnect and this huge worship of medications as the way to treat mental illness. And I am telling you, dietary therapy and ketogenic therapies in particular are such a better treatment for mental illness than I think most of the medications. And you know, don't come after my license, Big Pharma, because this is my opinion, but I think it is so superior in some, because it affects so many different pathways in so many different ways. And if you're trying to affect multiple pathways using multiple medications, you are going to have multiple nutrient deficiencies that then set that person up to develop really awful chronic diseases, right? And so yes, dietary therapy is so superior to psychopharm. And I'm so sorry that nobody has told people this. Wow. And I'm so sorry that so many clinicians are terrified to talk about it. Like, I think about Chris Palmer and every video he does, he's like, okay, but this is the standard of care. And I know he believes that. And I resonate with him when he says that, because it is such a strong social vibe that if you suggest anything other than medication, you don't get it. You're minimizing their symptoms. I don't think you understand. I am really sick. I am really mentally ill. I need my medication. So anyone who says anything other than medication, and maybe some therapy as an afterthought is somehow anti-treatment, which is not the case at all. So yeah, that's my thoughts on that.
Wow. Are you passionate about this at all?
Sorry.
I love this. No, this is, it's infectious. I can tell how important this is by the strength of your voice when you're talking about this. That's incredible. And I just think, I almost put it like with kind of cancer treatments where it's like, I'm not going to go out and tell people, you know, don't do radiation, don't do chemotherapy. You know, you should do those things. You should follow your doctor's advice. And you're right. Like maybe there is a role for certain medications, but even if diet was just an adjunct, if it was just something that kind of helped things along, if nothing else, like, yeah, this could absolutely cure you, but if nothing else, like, it's going to help improve a lot of things and you probably won't be diabetic and you can be really, you know, satiated and full yeah. with food that you've never experienced in your life. You might improve your digestive issues, your skin health, like so many other things could also improve. Yeah. And if yeah. this is so much more valuable than any medication, it's bananas that nobody's talking about it more.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And I think part of my passion comes from, I resent the social pressure on my profession to shut up about it. That is what, I think that is what makes me angry. And I think that is why I just, I think that's why I do talk about it the way I do, is that, you know, how dare you in try to influence what I know is actually very, very helpful for people, or that I've seen, like the therapists and the, you know, the nutritional psychiatrists and the functional psychiatrists that use this diet for mental illness have just seen miraculous recoveries. And for there to be some kind of professional pressure for us to shut up about that and to just continue with the standard of care, I resent. It makes me angry. Actually. And so, yeah, I just decided I'm not going to shut up about it anymore. And if I get in trouble, I get in trouble. But I think that people need to know that we don't have a lot of RCTs, but we do have some, and we have been studying the underlying mechanisms of ketones for a very long time. We do know quite a bit. And so this is evidence-based. Like when I made my blog, I was like, okay, you know, Georgia has her diagnosisdiet.com, which is super cool. Everyone should check that out. And Chris Palmer has his, and his, you know, he talks a lot about bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. And I was like, how am I going to do this? What do I want to do with this? And so what I did is I thought, okay, so what do ketones do? So I did some research on that. I was like, okay, so there seems to be, like, they do a lot. But kind of the four main ones that, you know, that they do is something called glucose hypometabolism. They fix that. They help brain energy. They're great for neurotransmitter imbalances. They reduce inflammation and they reduce oxidative stress. And I was like, okay, well, gosh, I wonder if that happens in all these different diagnoses that I'm always treating, right? And yes, they do. They absolutely do. Like there's different flavors, right? So like, for example, like neurotransmitter imbalances look different between panic disorder and depression, right? But they still exist. And ketogenic diets have mechanisms, you know, they're signaling bodies. They're able to turn genes on and off. They're able to do all kinds of stuff. So they have mechanisms that help with neurotransmitter imbalances. So even though I don't have RCTs for panic disorder, even though I don't have RCTs for social anxiety, even though I don't have the gold standard of RCT, and quite frankly, why would I wait for RCTs? My gosh, people are in pain now, right?
That's right.
Like right now. Am I going to wait 20 to 30, you know, I don't know, 15, 20 years? There's no money in ketogenic research. This is not big pharma driven. So there's a chance if I wait, these people are going to suffer for 10 or 15 more years, hoping, you know, this research is going to get out. I don't think that's going to happen very fast.
Wow.
So, even though I don't have RCTs for these things, there is RCTs for alcohol use disorder, by the way, and Alzheimer's, and soon binge eating disorder, I believe. But even though I don't have them for these specific disorders, does not mean that there is not an evidence base for the use of a ketogenic diet in treating them. Mm. And that is the bridge that I'm trying to kind of help people see. So when I write a blog post about panic disorder, for example, or social anxiety or PTSD, I'm doing research on that particular disorder. I'm identifying what of those four factors and a few extra, like brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that sort of thing. But gut microbiome is sometimes, you know, is very important in whatever disorder I'm researching. I look and say, what what identifying pathological mechanisms has the research found? Okay, great. I got it. And then I look at the ketogenic diet. I look at the where that's shown to help those things. And then I put those two together in a blog post. And I say, this is why this might help. And here's the evidence. And these blog posts are rich. I don't know if you got a chance to look at them, but they are rich with peer-reviewed research. I am not making this stuff up, people. I'm not some crazy quack who's like, oh, I really like this diet and it was great for me and I think you should use it. No, this is evidence-based. I'm going into the research. I'm researching what the disorder is. And then I'm looking to see what factors the ketogenic diet can help with that.
So we just love Nicole and all her work around brain health. And now we're going to go to Chris Palmer, who she's also mentioned today in our conversations. We're going to go to a conversation that we had with him. He is a doctor who explores ketogenic diets and the relation to some really scary mental conditions, including things like bipolar, Alzheimer's, dementia, that kind of thing. He's going to talk about the difference in the brain when the brain is struggling to uptake glucose, why a ketogenic diet can then help to give an alternate fuel source for a starving brain.
The reality is that all mental illnesses are syndromes, which means we don't know what causes any of them. We know risk factors for all of them, but we don't know how those risk factors fit together, and we don't know what causes any of them. The reality in terms of inflammation is that people with chronic mental illness tend to have higher levels of inflammation than people who don't have chronic mental illness. But it's not significant enough or consistent enough that we can diagnose anybody by doing a test for inflammation. And so you can have a mental illness and not have any elevated markers of inflammation. But on average, people with chronic mental illnesses tend to have higher levels of inflammation. So interestingly, you could say this that exact same thing that I just said for people with obesity, people with type 2 diabetes, for people with cardiovascular disease, but also for people who are just getting older. As people age, all of those things are true. And then you asked about glucose hypometabolism. So glucose hypometabolism is it's a word. Some people think it's automatically synonymous with insulin resistance. It's not entirely clear that that's true when we talk about the brain. It is true for most other parts of your body. If the cells in most other parts of your body do not have enough glucose to metabolize, the most common reason for that is what we would call insulin resistance, you know, or a lack of insulin, like in type 1 diabetes. But glucose hypometabolism in the brain, we know that insulin does play a significant role in the brain. It appears that some cells in the brain, insulin is playing a similar role to what it plays in the rest of the body, which is it's this gateway. It's this like lock and key mechanism to allow glucose to get into the cell. But in most brain cells, they actually don't need insulin for glucose to get inside the cell. And what we're learning is that insulin also appears to play a signaling role. Some might even consider it kind of a neurotransmitter or a brain hormone, but it's more than just, it has more to do with just its effects on letting glucose into a brain cell. But we know that glucose hypometabolism, so this problem with brain cells being energy deficient because they either aren't using glucose effectively or they don't have enough glucose to use. So it could be either one of those. It could either be that the cell is somehow not able to use the fuel source of glucose, or it could be that that fuel source has trouble getting into the cell. we know that that has been found in Alzheimer's disease. We know it's been found in schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, chronic depression, and many other disorders. Traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, lots of disorders have found this phenomenon of glucose hypometabolism. And at the end of the day, the way I think about that is that it, what it means is that those brain cells aren't getting enough energy, plain and simple.
All right. And how can a ketogenic diet, leading question, obviously, improve that problem?
So the obvious part of that is ketones are an alternate fuel source. So if for some reason glucose can't get inside cells, ketones can get inside cells. Ketones don't need a lock and key or any other mechanism. Ketones can get into your cells. Brain cells typically are not using fatty acids, but they are using ketones.
Neurons.
Neurons, yes, I should say. Yeah, as
opposed I always get on that. That's why.
As opposed to glial cells, yes. But the other thing about ketogenic diets related to what we just talked about is that we know that it improves insulin resistance. So if your insulin system is having trouble functioning properly, because it has become desensitized for whatever reason, we know that the ketogenic diet can improve that. The ketogenic diet also decreases neuroinflammation. So it decreases inflammatory signals in the brain. We have an abundance of evidence for that in the epilepsy literature. We have a really good, robust study for people with alcoholism, where the researchers at the federal government did a study of the ketogenic diet for alcoholism, and they found the same thing, that it decreases brain inflammation and it increases metabolism in brain cells that had trouble using glucose. There are many other mechanisms of the ketogenic diet. As you mentioned, gut microbiome might be one of them. But there are so many other mechanisms. We know that it balances neurotransmitters, it changes ion channels, it changes signaling pathways, it does all sorts of things. But I'll stop there for now, because those are very straightforward. And again, in this beautiful way, they address what we already know are clear pathological problems in the brains of people with chronic mental illness.
I don't think any discussion of the ketogenic diet could be complete without talking about some of the people who say that this way of life, this way of eating is actually bad. And they're citing different studies that are confirming those findings. And so Michelle Hearn is a registered dietitian and author of The Dietitian's Dilemma. And we pulled her on for a special episode back in episode 150, where we talked about the latest study. I can't even remember what it was. It's not worth even going back to checking it out. And the headlines that grabbed all the attention were that keto is bad and keto is going to kill you. And so we deep dive into that particular study and really talk about how studies are done. We talk about food frequency questionnaires, which I've seen one. I had the one from Harvard. It's 3 pages long. It's absolutely ridiculous. A food frequency questionnaire tells you a food and then gives you 6 or 7 different guesses to how many times you've eaten that food. And it could be like, I consume this food once a day. This could be once a week. It could be once every other week, whatever. It's not scientific. They're horribly inaccurate. And then they say things like cookie, one. Okay, well, like what kind of cookie? Are we talking like a giant crumble cookie? Or is this like a little Oreo cookie? Apple, one half or one can of apple. And it's like absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, they're totally crazy. This is how our guidelines are set. I'm not making this stuff up. We take information from these poorly done studies and we make dietary guidelines and tell every man, woman, and child in our country, in any society, society that they need to be eating a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet because of garbage studies like this that get all the attention. It obviously, I get a little worked up about this, and I'm going to get worked up a few times. We're going to use several clips from this conversation because it is so important. Next time somebody says, see, here's another headline that says keto is going to kill you, hopefully this will make you better equipped to know how to sniff out the bullshit, because it's absolutely bullshit. So let's talk a little bit about studies themselves, because there is a big difference between how studies are done, and they kind of almost have like a hierarchy of which ones you should listen to and trust the most. You know, what can you explain the difference between like epidemiology and like a randomized controlled trial?
Yeah, absolutely. So epidemiology deals with, we're looking at a group of people. We're like making observational studies. And what epidemiology is supposed to be used for is to then take your hypothesis and take it into a randomized controlled trial. Like, for example, let's say I saw a group of people eating a bunch of meat and they were really lean. Epidemiology would say, okay, these people are lean. They're lean because they eat a lot of meat. And that would be your study. That's epidemiology. I saw it, I observed it, and then I'm putting it out there. But what you actually need to do is you need to do a randomized controlled trial or study. You need to test that theory. Is it because they're eating a lot of meat? Does it have nothing to do with that? Is it because of something else? Because what epidemiology does is it says correlation equals causation. This is happening. A is happening, so it must be B, which is really dangerous because, you know, there's lots of memes and other things about this. It may have nothing to do with the other. So it can be really misleading.
Yeah. So in fairness, like doing a randomized controlled trial in nutrition is very, very difficult. I mean, I would consider, you know, the Minnesota coronary trial to be one that it's hard because you have to take, you know, groups of people, separate them, control every single variable that you possibly can, save one thing and follow those outcomes for a really long time. And like these diseases, you know, they take decades to build up. And so doing a randomized controlled trial is really difficult. But it's also, you're right, the causation correlation thing, if you look at a big group of people and start making, you know, guesses or assumptions based on how they're acting, that gets to be pretty tough. You can't show cause. I mean, the closest thing that I can think of that epidemiology has helped us out with was smoking, but they showed it was like 40 times more likely that, you know, somebody who smoked would get lung cancer versus somebody who wouldn't. Like, you have to get up to that level of certainty before you're even close to trying to link conclusions and causality, right?
Exactly. And yeah, randomized controlled trials are really challenging with humans, you know, and that's why a lot of times people will do them with rats or with, you know, other animals. And like you said, humans just, it's hard to control everything. You know, it's like with a rat or something, you can control exactly what they're eating, what time. You can do all these different tests. For humans, I mean, it's hard. Like you said, it's hard to get people that are willing to be followed, analyzed that for a specific period of time. And there's also not really money in it per se, unless you're trying to prove that some specific type of drug can fix an ailment, which is usually what randomized controlled trials do. But another thing is meta-analysis. You know, some really good studies are done by meta-analysis, meaning they look at thousands and thousands of people and get a ton of different data together and analyze all the different factors. And another issue we'll talk about with this nonsense keto study was they used a lot of food frequency questionnaires. So if anybody is listening to this and they're a dietitian or they know a dietitian or they've ever had to fill one of those out, like one, it asks you what you've eaten over the last few weeks. I don't remember what I ate yesterday. And people lie a lot on those things. You know, people generally will skew what they want the dietitian or the health professional they think they should answer. So basing something like an actual study off that is really, really a bad idea.
So I have the one from Harvard and it is absolutely ridiculous. It gives you a few different options on how often you eat apples, but they don't specify. It'll say like in parentheses, like an apple from a tree or a canned apple or something. And it's like, well, what kind of apple? Like, there's so much more context and nuance to that. And if you're listening to this, please, 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 I'm going to link this in the show notes. Go into the show notes and look up cups of ribs so you can see this point. There's a really funny short video where they're asking a guy like these types of questions, like, how often do you eat cheese? And he's like, he holds up six fingers. He's like, well, the only option is up to four. So he like puts four down, and you don't know how much, you know, cheese he's actually eating or what kind it is. And then it gets to ribs, and he says he eats like six ribs a week, and they're like, no, we need that measured in cups. And so he has to like hilariously blend it. It's really good. We're going to link to that. Make sure you see that. I wanted to just point out, like, those are a few different types of studies, but below that, like lower quality than that, is what we would call expert opinion, where this would be like a group of white coats doctors who say, we think this, we had a committee, maybe we had a vote, maybe it was unanimous, maybe it was 50-50, but we think this, and here you go. And a lot of people probably don't realize that's what our nutritional guidelines are based on.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the nutrition guidelines, I mean, there's a long history of how they came to be. And unfortunately, most people still believe that it has to do with human health and keeping, you know, as healthy, where in reality, you know, especially at this point in history, it really has to do with, you know, corporate sponsorship, money. There's very little to do with human health. I mean, we have lots of evidence that, you know, eating processed carbohydrates and eating, you know, too many carbohydrates in general can cause diabetes, obesity, heart disease, metabolic syndrome. Yet, you know, that remains the bottom of the food pyramid. Or now it's the My Plate. You know, they change it all the time. We know in 2014, they came out with, they found out that the Harvard scientists were paid to put the blame on fat instead of sugar for heart disease. And this occurred in the 60s, that they basically threw fat under the bus when it was very evident that sugar and elevated glycemic index was the driver of heart disease. But back then you didn't have to release who was funding your study. You do actually have to do that today. So the public had no idea, you know, so we just, over time, there's been so much corporate influence, even into my profession. You know, the dietitians, the governing board of all dietitians, the Academy of Nutrition is highly sponsored by processed food companies, Frito-Lay, General Mills, used to be Coca-Cola and Hershey's. I also found out today they're a national, there's a new one I didn't know about, National Confectioners Association. Wow. So that's a new one for 2021. So the Sugar Candy Association. It's just, you know, when you have those corporate sponsors, your main goal as a business is to make sure your shareholders and stakeholders have profit, right? See profits coming. And that can only happen if we're keeping people perpetually sick. We can't heal people. So it's really sad. You know, it's a business. It's not designed for health. I think most people might know that on some level, but unfortunately, if you're depending on the healthcare system to help you with your chronic diseases, you're going to be very disappointed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just yesterday I was in the store and you walk by the vending machine, and on the vending machine with, you know, gallons of soda behind it, there's the little sticker that says balance what you eat, drink, and do. And it's like the food companies are there to confuse you and mislead you so that you'll buy their products and think you can walk this off later. Like, this isn't going to cause any damage. So stupid. So I want to talk about this study in particular and some of the claims, and maybe we can deep dive into some of the things they're saying and what that was based on and why it's just totally bullshit.
Sure, let's do it.
Awesome. So what was their first claim? I want to say that, let's see, they said it was the most comprehensive review yet, that keto will cause heart attacks, cancer risk, dangers to pregnant women, and kidney patients. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Gosh, I feel like they had one. I mean, they had a bunch, but those were kind of like their big five, right? Like, okay. And I mean, just looking at that, like, it makes me really frustrated because let's just break it down. So let's talk about pregnant women. I mean, I can't think of a time, you know, I'm 38. I don't have kids, but my, the youngest of four, my three older sisters have children, you know, and that's a time in your life when you're doing everything in your power to make sure your baby is safe, right? Like, people will change all kinds of things in their life just to make sure that the baby is born healthy and safe. And so to see something like that is terrifying. Like, oh my God, if I'm a low carbohydrate eater, then my baby is going to, you know, I might have neural tube defects. Well, when I looked at this study, the study was so bad. It was actually sent to a review board. I saw a doctor said, you need to change the name of this study, because they were actually comparing a low carbohydrate diet to people that had folate fortified high carbohydrate diets. So what does that mean? They were comparing people who were just eating low carbohydrate foods to people who were actually eating like cereals and breads and things that were fortified. So it was like that. You can't do that. You can't compare non-fortified foods to fortified foods. And they're also making the claim that a low carbohydrate diet is low in folate. And that's nonsense. If you're a ketogenic human, you eat greens and you eat, other things, other maybe vegetation that has some folate, but eggs, meat, liver, extremely high in folate. And those are all things that are very low carbohydrate. And also they fail to mention in the study, if you actually like really dig into it, the low carbohydrate people that had the neural tube defects were also smoking and drinking. So they didn't tease that out. Wow. But you just like, you can't, I had to actually go and pull up the study and look at it. So yes, if you are a high carbohydrate human and you're eating fortified corn flour and wheat flour, which these people were, versus somebody who is eating low carbohydrate, very low quality foods. Like if you're just eating like, you know, butter and not that butter is a low quality food, but just you're not eating anything with folate and you're smoking and drinking, then yes, you will have a higher risk. But that's a totally different statement, right? And the person who actually, the review board that went after them said, I am concerned because carbohydrates are a contributing factor to obesity, that by saying this, you're actually scaring people away from a low carbohydrate diet and encouraging them to continue on with a high carbohydrate diet. So it was like, it's just, I mean, but the study was just so poorly done. Like you, once again, if you're going to compare high carbohydrate fortified foods, then you have to compare low carbohydrate with fortified foods.
Sure.
And then if you're going to have the people that are smoking and drinking with low carbohydrate, guess what? You have to do the same thing or you have to eliminate those people, right? Like in studies, if somebody doesn't fit within the parameters, and certainly that can impact pregnancy, then yeah. And so that was really frustrating to me, that study was just really, really poorly done.
Wow. My mind went to two places. First of all, our evolution, like whenever would we had, you know, constant year-round access to high carbohydrate foods to begin with. And then thinking about indigenous populations up in the north, like they have children, do their pregnant women just like drop dead all the time? Like if you go back 100 years and see their diet, it's protein and fat. They don't have vegetation. They can't eat, you know, plants. Maybe a little bit, it's part of the year, but most of the time they're going to be high fat, high protein. Do their pregnant women just drop dead all the time? Like that would make no sense.
No. And I also was looking at other, case reports and studies, and people who ate the most animal products tend to have really high folate levels, right? Because they're getting a lot of the B12 and folate, especially in the darker, the more, ruminant animals like lamb, beef, venison, and more indigenous people, if you're hunting like wild game. And throughout history and throughout evolution, you know, humans did more of like a nose to tail, right? They didn't just do the muscle mass or muscle meats. They would do the organs. They would do all the collagens and tissues and things. And we know that organs are extremely high in folate as well. So, you know, it wasn't really until I was looking through this more of people really started the agricultural revolution where people were eating a lot of like rices and potatoes and things like that. And they weren't eating any plant material that we started to see a lot more of the neural tube defects. And you know, it's really interesting, and kind of a follow-up article to this was suggesting like, is it really the best process for humans to fortify all of our cereals and grains and breads with folate to make sure people may not have these neural tube defects? Or would it make more sense to really teach people how to eat foods that are naturally high in folate, be it the greens, the meats, the eggs, the muscle meats, so they naturally get that folate? And obviously I think you and I agree on what we would prefer that humans do and humans eat. Also interesting, just to wrap up this study, one other thing that the people that had a low carbohydrate diet that did have the neural tube defects, it was unplanned pregnancies. So most of the time, you know, if you're trying to get pregnant, you want to get pregnant, you will be probably not drinking, you know, and probably trying to eat a little bit different, maybe a little healthier, where a lot of the people in the study that were on the higher carb diet were actively seeking to get pregnant. So, you know, just other confounding factors that were not mentioned in the study or the report that are present in the actual study. So,
wow. So if you're a pregnant woman, you know, who's scared shitless about the study, like what would you encourage them to eat more of, and how should they be constructing their diet? Is it just a lot of variation on whatever, like healthy meat and, you know, fruits, vegetables, things like that they should be consuming?
Yeah. Like whatever, you know, if you're pregnant, like kind of depending on what, if you're already following a specific way of eating, like if you're already a low carb eater or a, you know, carnivore, ketogenic eater, you're likely getting some good animal-based protein. You know, if you are a vegan or vegetarian, I would definitely encourage you to look at what has folate. And unfortunately, you know, just any type of vitamins, minerals from plant material tends to be less absorbed than animal products. So that might be an instance where you want to look at a folic acid supplement. But if you are eating meat, which I'm a big advocate for animal-based proteins, then yeah, continue to eat those ruminant animals, whatever you like, beef, lamb, venison, eggs is another good source. And then liver is probably one of the best sources. So I would say having that a few times a week is gonna pretty much guarantee that you're gonna get adequate folate stores.
Do you see how stupid this is? This is not a study that should have ever been published. This is so poorly done. I hope you're getting a good sense of this as we continue with our conversation with Michelle. I wanted to look at a recent headline and a group of doctors that come up with a ranking of diets every single year. I looked through to see who these doctors were, and I did see a familiar face in Dr. Mark Cucuzzella fighting the good fight and representing the low carbohydrate space. But pretty much every other doctor that's on this panel or health expert on this panel basically is pushing a plant-based agenda and is normally paid by somebody in the industry. If you start to look these people up, you'll find who they are. And they go through and rank every single year the diets. You know, there was 40 on this list, and they rank them from very best to very worst. So I just want to point out a few of these. I went and looked this up so I could read this on the air. The number one best diet, according to this group, is the Mediterranean diet. Now, think about the Mediterranean area. That is a massive area where people are eating vastly different diets. A Mediterranean diet is not what people in the Mediterranean area eat. It is an idea. It's like a trademark. They had to invent the Mediterranean diet in the 1990s, and they did so by promoting olive oil as a fat that could come back and you know, be a fat that people could eat, because we'd already bastardized saturated fat. And then, you know, we were starting to learn that vegetable oils were not good for you. So olive oil was a way to promote the olive oil production in those countries, especially like Italy and Greece, and get that oil back in the diet and show them that it was healthy. And they flew people all over the place to the Mediterranean, where it was absolutely beautiful, all these nutritionists. And then they came home promoting this particular, think of it as like a brand of a diet. It's not actually what people in the Mediterranean eat. If you travel over there, you would probably know that it's vastly different. Okay, so that was the number one diet. Number five, volumetrics. Never heard of it. Have you heard of the volumetric diet? Never heard of it. 13th, Asian diet. What is the Asian diet? Asia is massive. There are lots of different countries and different cultures and lots of different ways to eat. They weren't very much more specific than just saying it's the Asian diet, and that took 13th. Biggest Loser diet took 20th. We know from studies that that will absolutely crush your metabolic rate. And yes, those people can lose a lot of weight in a short amount of time, but they all gain it back, and they don't gain back their metabolic rate or the number of calories that they eat. There will be permanent damage from doing that type of calorie restriction and exercise program. That's 20th. Nutrisystem took 24th. SlimFast took 26th. The ketogenic diet and the modified ketogenic diet, whatever that is, both tied for 37. And the next one down is called the Dukin diet. I have no idea what the Dukin diet is. If you find out what the Dukin diet is, please share it with me so I can understand. This is what people are Googling. Right? They hear that somebody's doing really well on a ketogenic diet. So they Google this. They see this list of all these diets popping up and see at the very bottom that ketogenic diets are ranked dead last or near dead last. And then they go off and do something different or stay on a standard American diet. These types of you know, panels are designed to keep people confused about nutrition. And it sucks because lots of people are getting very fat and very sick. And to be able to make money on those people, you need to keep them fat and keep them sick and keep them alive, which is, again, this convergence of the food industry, the medical system, and pharmaceuticals. All of them are making money when people are getting sick and diabetic and having dementia and brain problems at earlier and earlier ages. This is exactly what happens, and this is why people can make lots of money when you don't know this information, which is being hidden from you and is being distorted every time you see one of these stupid headlines. Again, I'm getting way too worked up, so I'm going to let you finish this conversation with Michelle. I'm going to go grab a glass of water or something. Okay, this is a big one. People see this a lot. They get really concerned with this, and it's keto diets cause an increase in your bad cholesterol. That's quoted from the study, increase bad cholesterol.
Yeah, that really frustrated me, because I kind of feel like I I feel like that was something like my mom would call me and ask, like maybe somebody who doesn't really understand, you know, doesn't have a medical background, or maybe just somebody at this grocery store. But that's not something a medical professional should say, because we know now. I mean, LDL is the like black sheep of the blood proteins, but LDL has so many important functions in your body, right? LDL is part of our immune system. And we have data, we have clinical data that people with higher LDL, specifically older people, actually had a increased outcomes when they had respiratory disease or gastrointestinal disease. The higher the LDL, the actually better they were at surviving. I mean, I can read you a couple of studies here. I actually pulled them out. Meta-analysis of 68,000 people. The goal was to analyze what impact, if any, the total cholesterol of an individual had on the individual dying from infectious disease. The study found an inverse correlation. The higher the individual's total cholesterol and LDL, the less likely they were to die of a respiratory infection. Wow. A 15-year study of 120,000 patients, those with the highest total cholesterol had the lowest risk of being admitted to a hospital with an infection. And finally, a large meta-analysis of over 600,000 people. The study's reviewers concluded current evidence does not clearly support cardiovascular guidelines that encourage high consumption of polyunsaturated fatty acids and low consumption of total saturated fats. So basically, you're not doing yourself any favors chugging the canola oil and olive oil and going easy on the eggs and stuff, right? So yeah, LDL, I think LDL scares people because we see it in arteries, right? We see, and we see it, it looks like things that are saturated fat, like butter, tallow. It looks like, you know, it's hard. It looks like the plaque we see in arteries. And so people, you know, doctors, especially in the 60s and 70s, you'd open up an artery, you'd see this LDL, you know, in there with that plaque, and you'd be like, oh my God, LDL caused plaque. And that was wrong. That was once again going back to does correlation equal causation. I see it here. It caused that. But what we found is that when LDL on its own is not enough to harden arteries, LDL on its own, you know, serves a lot of important functions. LDL is essential in helping you break down fatty acids. You would become malnourished without enough LDL because you need to break down the fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K. LDL is important in your immune system. Like we just talked about, not having respiratory diseases, gastrointestinal diseases. We actually have a study in my book, people with higher LDLs survived COVID better. So yeah, LDL on its own, poor LDL is getting blamed for heart disease. So why then, right? Like, why are we seeing it stuck in arteries? Well, we have a lot of evidence that when arteries become damaged, when there's inflammation in arteries, it's almost like they become sticky. And LDL gets stuck. It's almost like this. You can think of it as like LDL is going to like try to fix the damage, or LDL is going to try to like, you know, fix that inflammation. So what's causing the inflammation in the arteries? Do you have any idea?
Maybe sugar.
Yes. Yes. Bingo. And not necessarily just sugar, but hyperglycemia. When your blood sugar is elevated over time, that's why people with diabetes, Casey, have up to a fourfold risk of having heart disease. When you're, I mean, there's like five or six really good studies in this, and I can send them to you. They're in my book, that when blood sugar is elevated over time, it starts to change the pH of your blood. And when that happens, it can damage the arteries, the artery walls of your heart, the artery walls of, you know, other things. People can get aneurysms in your brain. So you really, really, really don't want to have hyperglycemia. You don't want to be diabetic. Over time, it causes a lot of issues, because in the absence of diabetes, in the absence of high blood sugar and inflammation and oxidation, more LDL can actually be a really good thing. So the study just, the keto study, it was just a bunch of nonsense. It was saying that, you know, meat and fat raise your LDL. That's 1,000% true. They're right. But they correlated that to causing heart disease. And once again, on its own, that does not cause heart disease. Mm. Throughout evolution, people ate meat and fat almost exclusively. We had zero risk of heart disease. We added lots of processed carbs, oils, sugars, you know, cereals, breads, and all of a sudden heart disease has increased exponentially. You cannot tell me that it's the meat and fat.
Yeah. It makes no fucking sense. It makes no fucking sense. And I'm so grateful for people like Dave Feldman, who, you know, his personal story is so amazing. He's one of the most world-renowned cholesterol experts in the world. But like he's not even a doctor. He's not a researcher. He was a software engineer who needed to lose some pounds a few years ago. So he goes on a keto diet, everything improves. He loses weight. He feels way better, but his LDL goes up. So he goes to his doctor and says like, yo, what's going on? And ends up doing all this research and discovers that the cholesterol systems in our body work like an energy delivery system. And it's just part of the system. It's just part of what should happen. And the things that go along with that, like the pattern that he saw with himself is that his LDL, quote unquote, bad cholesterol shot up. But he also noticed that his HDL, the one we call like the good or the more protective cholesterol, that also went up. His triglycerides were the other big one. His triglycerides were very, very low. So that's the fat that travels around in the blood, but it's caused by eating a lot of carbohydrates. And so he's been looking for a pattern where, you know, if this happens to somebody, is this a bad thing? And he's been looking for years and years, and to my knowledge, studied thousands and thousands of cholesterol profiles and has never found that to be dangerous or harmful in the least.
1,000%. You know, when I worked in the hospital and I saw patients with heart disease, they always had very high LDL, low HDL, extremely high triglycerides. And I would say 95% of the time had, hyperglycemia, were diabetic, had an A1C often over 9 or 10. but when you're eating a low carbohydrate diet, your blood sugar, you know, tends to be stable. I mean, it tends to be really low. It tends to be, you know, you're not diabetic. Triglycerides tend to be 40 or under. And so, yeah, once again, that higher LDL, I'm not concerned about. You know, it's like people want to look at LDL in a vacuum, which is a big mistake. And then of course, you have people that say like, oh, you can have heart disease even if you're not diabetic. Yes, of course, there's instances with other systemic inflammation, you know, lupus, some type of autoimmune diseases can cause inflammation outside of blood sugar, but I can guarantee you that's not the main driver of issues in our nation. You know, it's a very small percentage. So, you know, really driving this, and what really frustrates me about this, the physicians committee study, is that, you know, a ketogenic diet actually prevents heart disease, right? It's going to keep your blood sugar low. It's going to, you know, keep your blood sugar stable. It's going to keep your A1C low, where when you eat these plant-based diets that they're recommending, you tend to eat a lot more carbohydrates, you know, and those are the things that raise your triglycerides. And those are the things that over time can raise your blood sugar and raise your A1C and actually contribute to heart disease. So that frustrates me a lot. And I think you can just Google LDL online right now and it'll tell you it's the bad cholesterol, which is just really, it's really unfortunate and ill-informed. And it's also caused so many people to walk into a doctor's office and get a statin, mm-hmm. a prescription statin to help lower LDL. So once again, we know now that LDL can be a really good thing, can be really protective. So now we want to lower it. it's not good. And I shared that, you know, when I worked in the hospital, I worked on a rehab floor, not like drug rehabilitation, like rehab for when people were in like an accident, they were going to be there for several months, maybe had a stroke, a major burn. And I started to see a really scary pattern with a lot of people who came in who had had strokes that had been on an LDL for 6 months to a year. And I actually brought that information to our clinical director and said, look, I've been keeping track, you know, no names or anything for HIPAA, but there's a large percentage of people. I just noticed a trend. And I was immediately told, like, when I got my medical license, I could come back, you know, wow. go to your dietitian work, stop, mind your own business, right? So it's just, we have a really backward system right now. We have a system where people believe that all carbohydrates are good. Sugar in moderation is fine. Meat and fat will kill you. But yeah, the whole LDL and heart disease thing, it's just really unfounded. It's not true.
Yeah, that's crazy. And if you're the listener and you have this pattern happen to you where your LDL shoots up when you're trying a low carbohydrate diet, if you get confused about this, reach out to somebody who can help you answer questions or can show you different markers to be looking at that can tell you other things. Like, sure, we can investigate this and we can look at other, you know, subfractionated particles of LDL, or we can look at things like HDL, triglycerides, A1C can be really important. There's other things that you can do. So don't be confused. Reach out to me, reach out to Michelle, anybody who can help you find, you know, the right things to be looking at. That one just, it's so fucking frustrating. I get endlessly frustrated by that one. Since we have been talking about cholesterol, we're now going to cut away from this conversation to go to a conversation that we had recently with Dr. Adrian Soto-Moda out of Mexico City. He is doing wonderful work with Dave Feldman. You heard his name already in this conversation. Since we're talking about cholesterol, we wanted to show you this clip. Imagine being a software engineer. This was Dave Feldman, who had some weight to lose. So he hears about a low-carbohydrate ketogenic diet. He goes on the diet, loses a bunch of weight, feels as good as he ever has. Again, this is not somebody with a health background. This is a software engineer. He goes to get a blood work done, and they show him that his triglycerides, or the liquid form of fat that comes from carbohydrates in the diet, is very low, which is great. They show him that his HDL cholesterol is really high, which is protective and really good. But they show him that his LDL cholesterol, what everybody says is bad cholesterol, is super elevated, like really, really high. And it didn't happen with some of his family members who were actually a little bit bigger than him and had more weight to lose. And this sent Dave, the software engineer, on this lifelong quest to figure out what was going on. And his research is absolutely amazing. Nothing is proven from the data that we're getting and that we were going to learn about here from Dr. Adrian Soto-Moda, but I think this will start to pave the way for us to finally show that LDL cholesterol, is not a primary driver of heart disease. I really think that they are showing a completely different model of how cholesterol moves through the body and how you can either probably do okay having a high LDL cholesterol level, or you can learn about simple ways that you can bring that LDL cholesterol down, as it is an extremely dynamic number that can move around a lot. So let's go to this conversation. This might get a little bit technical, but I do think it's so important to learn about, because if you are lean and you go on a ketogenic diet, this is very likely to happen to you as well. Okay, so let me try to set this up, and correct me if I goof any of this kind of thing up, but I want to set this up in a way that the listener will kind of understand what's going on and understand more of Dave's work. So Dave decides several years ago that he wants to go on a low-carbohydrate diet. He's tried other diets. He does research on a low-carbohydrate diet, and he gets fantastic results. He feels better. He loses weight. He loses fat. He's not an obese guy, but definitely loses some excess fat. And he's feeling amazing, and everything seems to be going great. He goes to a blood draw. He notices that his triglycerides, so basically like the energy, fat energy that's traveling around in the blood that comes from carbohydrate primarily, is really low. So that's really good. The HDL number that he gets back, which every doctor says this is the quote unquote good cholesterol, is actually really high. So that's really good. But then he notices that his LDL cholesterol, or what every doctor pretty much will tell you is your quote unquote bad cholesterol, is now really high. Very high, the way that you described your own. In a week on low carbohydrate, your LDL cholesterol goes from 100 to nearly double that. It's a big, big jump. And so it's like, okay, I'm feeling amazing. I lost weight. Everything else seems to be going good. But now I'm scared to death because the bad cholesterol that's going to give me a heart attack is now really, really high. Do I have that kind of situation?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the scenario.
Okay.
That's an accurate description of that particular scenario. And then he notices that when he reintroduces some carbs, LDL goes down massively. And I really cannot state the magnitude of these LDL drops. There is no drug that achieves this magnitude of LDL reduction in that time.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Like maybe a slight reduction, by taking whatever statin drug for a long time or whatever. But yeah, you're right. There's nothing that can cause literally like hundreds. I've seen the number drop by hundreds of points in a very short amount of time. And so what does this kind of summarizing, what does this lead Dave to believe and explore about how the body uses cholesterol?
And this is why I mean that he's a fantastic scientist and a fantastic, perhaps non-formally trained scientist. I mean, he's an engineer, so of course he's familiar with organized thinking. You know, he's a clever guy. So he acknowledges that he observed something that most people didn't expect, and that is not explained by the current model of how things work. So his true scientist way of thinking is, okay, unexplained observation, the model for explaining these phenomenon should be revisited. Then perhaps the model most people use or have needs to be refined. And so he starts applying his organized thinking into, okay, what does LDL do? What does triglycerides do? Where are LDL particles produced, or where do LDL particles come from? What are LDL particles made of, and where they go, and what regulates or influences the rate they deliver, the energy they transport, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He started basically doing a PhD, reading as much as possible from this particular topic, and organized in an organized way. Okay, this explains this doesn't. How, with what we know and understand about these mechanisms and models, how do we make sense of this? And he deducts a model that later on, after extensive literature review, and now some insightful data points, seems to be perhaps not the last and definitive version of how lipid metabolism works, but certainly a powerful one. Because in any other field of knowledge, a model is as strong as its predictions. And that's why the lipid energy model paper focuses so much on making testable predictions. It's a hypothesis. And it makes sense because of A to C references. And the best we propose to test it out is with the following measurements within the following context. So Dave, basically, using organized thinking and good deduction and good literature review, arrived to a set of ideas that are, first of all, testable. So they are scientific. If it's not falsifiable, it's not scientific, Karl Popper would say. And that makes sense with what we understand and with the body of evidence that has been produced in different contexts. So I think, I mean, again, it was the product of objective and organized observations and data collection, extensive literature review, with a naive and perhaps naive in the way of not previously biased by taught ideas from an academic background, and deduction power. So that's pretty much how the lipid energy model came to be. And of course, when others and I jumped into the wagon, we brought perhaps some, or we found different pieces of evidence in the literature that support these mechanisms.
Wow. Yeah, so interesting. You mentioned the data collection. I know he spent a long, long amount of time collecting all of the data that he did, which was a really arduous task. I know he spent months and months getting all the data, years actually. So he finally collects all of this data. And what were some of the findings? What really surprised you from some of the findings? And maybe we should go back and say, with the lipid energy model, what are we saying? What are we saying is happening with all of these LDLs? Like, what's the hypothesis before we get to the end results, I guess?
Well, one of the main hypotheses is that when carbohydrates are restricted to meet energy demands, the liver secretes more VLDLs, which are quickly transformed into LDLs via the activity of lipoprotein lipase. So this is different because when carbohydrates are not restricted, there is not so much pressure on the liver to secrete VLDLs. Why VLDLs are secreted more? Because they need to meet energy demands. And actually, one of the parts of the lipid energy model paper emphasizes that anything that increases energy demand should push this VLDL secretion up, which could be cold exposure. And there are literature examples where cold exposure is associated with leanness for VLDL particles, like physical activity, which is something they've observed before. LMHR people tend to be physically active. So it makes sense, and it makes sense with the body of literature involving ANG, VTL, 8 and 3 and 4 system. And the main observation or the main hypothesis is in the context of carbohydrate restriction, the liver secretes more VLDL to meet energy demands. And these VLDL are quickly transformed into LDL through an expanded or increased activity of lipoprotein lipase. And because LDL have a longer half-life in the bloodstream, they accumulate. Mm. So this explains why, this explains two very powerful things. Why LDL goes up in the context of carbohydrate restriction. It explains why LDL goes down when carbohydrates are reintroduced. Because when carbohydrates are reintroduced, then the liver does not have so much pressure for releasing fats. It can go, it can store glycogen and share more glucose. And therefore, after 2 or 3 days, these LDLs go down because not much more VLDL are secreted. So it explains both observations, and it explains as well, or predicts why lean people should have larger LDL elevations, because when having less peripheral fat stores, your liver has much pressure to redistribute these VLDL.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting. Okay. So that was the hypothesis. What did you guys learn from the actual data from the study?
Well, Dave organized the cholesterol super survey, which was an amazing feat. He basically organized an online survey where people could upload their lipid panel before going carbohydrate restriction and then after carbohydrate restriction. And they also introduced how many days were between tests. One of the challenges of this database was that, for example, people sometimes uploaded more than one test. They used it to see their progress or to follow their lipids. So, of course, we had to remove repeated measurements for the same individual. Not because there's anything wrong with them, but because they would be overrepresented. So we have to deal with that. Or people sometimes, I mean, humans, despite how smart is our natural intelligence, we can still screw up with the keyboard and introduce some nonsensical values. Or sometimes people forget that one of the things that they wanted to collect was people without lipid medications. So some people uploaded their results despite having statins, et cetera, et cetera. And what we found was that one of the strongest predictors, if not the strongest predictor for a large LDL change, was the baseline BMI. In other words, the leaner you are, the larger your LDL changes before versus after carbohydrate restriction were. So relevant small technical parenthesis, a linear model tries to predict value with other factors or with values from other variables. The first time I heard about the LMHR phenotype, which is defined with lipid values, with the triglyceride value, with the HDL value, and with the LDL value, the first thing I thought was, perhaps not knowing this, Dave proposed the linear model for predicting who is going to be lean. Because the LMHR, I mean, despite the name has lean in the, you know, the name of the phenotype, lean mass hyperresponders, they are not defined by being lean. They are defined by their lipid panel values. And I saw a lecture where Dave was doing this almost party trick of predicting who was the owner of a particular lipid panel. What he was doing, even if he knew it or not, was using a linear model for predicting with a logistical regression who is going to be lean. So that was one of the things I wanted to test when I got this particular set of data. And in the end, it's true. One of the best things you can do is to use the computer and its immense calculation power, and then tell the computer, look, these are all the data. Choose the variables you want with the cutoffs you want to tell me how, which ones are, which variables and the respective cutoffs are the most useful for predicting who will have the largest LDL elevations. And the first variable was BMI, and the first cutoff was 26. Basically, WHO's definition for being overweight or lean. So this is when something as unbiased as a computer arrives to the same conclusion that someone observed. I mean, that reassures me, but that was not the only thing we analyzed. We put different models to compete with and without BMI, a model with and without BMI, a model with and without triglycerides to HDL ratio, et cetera, and consistently, BMI is one of the best predictors for who will have the largest LDL observations. After that, because an empirical definition, so to speak, for LMHRs already existed, which was Dave's, we created these subgroups of, okay, these people meet the definition, these people does not meet the definition, because that database had people undergoing carbohydrate restriction from different BMI levels. So, okay, these people fulfills the LMHR criteria regardless of their BMI or not. And sure enough, people who do have lower BMIs, we compare those data against NHANES data and showed how people, LMHRs and non-LMHRs, start carbohydrate restriction pretty much with the same distribution NHANES has. But those who are LMHR go way further in their LDL elevations. So they have pretty much the same starting point, but they don't have the same length for LDL elevations. I mean, testing the same idea consistently resulted in BMI is definitely related with how large your LDL elevations will be.
We're going to go now back to the conversation we had with Michelle Hearn on the special episode that we did on 150. So we can wrap this all up, and we're really going to get into this plant-based movement, which again, we're going to make the case as strongly as we can. I would say that a plant-based diet, the plant-based movement itself, is an absolute scam. I am with Jane Buxton as she wrote the book, The Great Plant-Based Con, telling people that a plant-based diet is good for your health and is also good for the planet. I think both of those things are absolutely untrue. And the more we get this message out, the better it's going to be, and the better we can really help people to find the real solutions that can help not only our health, but the health of our planet. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. I do want to say also, Michelle's going to mention attacks from vegans, and it's so funny. I find this so curious why vegans would waste any time going onto my YouTube channel or anybody else in the low-carbohydrate, carnivore, keto space, why they would waste any time attacking us for whatever we're doing or calling us stupid or saying our research is dumb. They never have anything to back it up. They never really have anything nice to say, and that they would spend any time, you know, throwing rocks at us for what we're doing. I can tell you, again, just based on anecdote, nobody who's eating a carnivore diet is spending a lot of time researching and trashing vegans. We want to understand, and we want to build bridges and have answers to questions that we're all, you know, looking for as far as diet. But I can tell you, I don't know of a single carnivore who's wasting time trashing vegans and telling them they're stupid or that what they're doing isn't great. We honor and respect anybody, whatever they want to eat. It's crazy to me that this would go the other way and people would spend time and go and leave stupid comments on my YouTube channel. So anyway, here's the last of the conversation that I had with Michelle Hearn about studies and headlines around low carbohydrate diets.
That's the power of marketing and propaganda, right? That there's genuinely people out there that believe that eating a Beyond Burger that was created in Silicon Valley, you know, and having, you know, avocados and quinoa flown in from around the country is like better for the planet and better for their health than just eating a meat you get at your local farmer's market. It's really sad. And it's just not how the human species was designed to be. Like if somebody came up to me and said, like, look, I just, I hate the taste of meat. I can't eat it. Texture is terrible. I know it's good for my health. I just can't do it. I'd be like, okay, that's fair. Like, you're an adult. You get to choose what you want to do. But to be like, oh, that's bad for you. That's bad for the planet. That's false. Like, you know, just like any other species, you know, humans have the physiology. They have the digestive system to effectively break down and extract nutrition very well from animal products. We are not able to do that very well from plant products. So,
yeah, I mean, that's exactly how I know where the money is flowing in this whole scheme, because it's like you have, you know, the one set of people that love the planet and love, you know, animals and would never eat them. And they get so angry, like to the level of like death threats to certain people. And everybody on the other side is like, we're just cool. Like, you can go do whatever you want. We're not trying to tear you down. Like, if I'm selling Ford cars, I'm going to go learn about Ford cars. I'm not going to go to the street corner and yell at everybody who drives a Chevy and say they're a fucking idiot. Like, that makes no sense.
Yeah, it's an emotionally charged argument. It's not a logical, scientifically charged argument, I found, and I often get attacked by traditional dietitians and vegans, and it's very emotion based. And you can't argue with emotion, and I'm not interested in that. Like, you and I talked offline. Like, my goal is to share my story and what's helped heal me and what the science says and what I've seen. I've seen amazing transformations, physical transformations, people losing hundreds of weight and reversing diabetes and, all kinds of different like skin issues. And they just look like a different human. But even more importantly to me is the mental transformations I've seen, you know, in myself. I got rid of lifelong anxiety. I've seen people debilitating depression, suicidal ideation that have just come out of it. People with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia have their symptoms improve, all by switching from a standard American diet or a vegan diet to a very high animal-based, high-fat, low-carb animal-based diet. So, you know, if this way of eating can help people, I'm all about it. I have no interest in getting on other websites and fighting and screaming and whatever. Like, that's just silly to me.
Yeah, totally agree. We have seen so many amazing transformations, and we're the same. We would just like to sit in our little corner of the world. And if people want to join us for this magical adventure and, you know, increased, you know, quality of life and mental clarity and energy, and, you know, you want to play with your kids and not have your joints hurt, like, come along with us. We're so willing to share. If you don't want to, that's fine. I'm not going to go start bitching at you on Twitter because you don't. Like, it's okay. Like, we just want to show you that there might be a better way. There's one kind of last thing I want to point out, that it's so effective and it's so tricky and scammy. And I see it all the time. And one of the things that they said in the study was, if you eat more keto foods, that's going to weed out other foods that are healthy, like vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. And it's an interesting claim that has no basis in science. It wasn't cited linked to a study. So it's an interesting way of making an assumption based on what everybody just at this point just kind of thinks they know. And it's almost like, if you go back like 40 or 50 years and you see a car go by really fast and it's red, and you say, wow, that car is really fast and it's red. And if you keep repeating the message, you might be able to slowly start working in the message that red cars are fast. And it's basing the whole argument on something that isn't necessarily proven or true. It's just what somebody thinks about it, and everybody jumps on that bandwagon, and you have this like straw man argument that is, well, fruits and vegetables and whole grains are healthy. We all know that. And if you eat more meat, you're not going to eat as much of that stuff. It's bullshit. It's really effective.
It's so funny. It's like, I would come back at them with like the opposite argument. You know, I would say like, I wish people would eat less fruits and vegetables and whole grains, specifically the whole grains, and more meat and fat. You know, what they're using and what I often see in the vegan community, and even in this study cited, that fruits, vegetables, and whole grains are high in fiber. Fiber helps reduce LDL. We've already gone over that. That's not necessarily helpful, but that's kind of their sticking point, you know? And I know a lot of people who eat a low carbohydrate ketogenic diet and still include fruits and vegetables. You know, it's not like, certainly there are a lot of vegetables out there that are low carb. Some people like myself who are very active, you know, I'm an ultra runner. that I, you know, I certainly eat some berries here and there, but I'm also like, even when I was zero carb for a while, like I'm not worried about my nutritional status. You can get all the nutrition you need from meat and fat. There's not a single nutrient. There's not a vitamin, a amino acid. And that's not true for the plant kingdom. That's like, maybe we should say that louder. Like you cannot get, if you are a vegan and you do not supplement your diet, you will die or you will get very sick because there is no B12. There is no K2. There is no perform vitamin A, you know, and that's why we often see people. There's a reason that vegans have statistically very low B12 and low EPA and DHA, very susceptible to bone fractures. Lots of different things. So you don't need fruit. You don't need vegetables. You do need meat and fat. Can you have some fruit and vegetables on a ketogenic diet? Absolutely. And yeah, that's great. And the more quote unquote whole grains that people eat, I feel like the more the sicker we've gotten as a nation. You know, I work in the hospital, people were eating toast and rice and pasta and, you know, and now of course, whole grains are in cereals and cookies and crackers. People are quote unquote eating whole grains all day and it's killing us as a nation. So yeah, I'll come back to them and say, hey, if you eat keto, you're going to eat less of these. Good. You should be. I wish my diabetic patients would stop eating bananas. And I wish the population in general would stop eating, you know, breads and cereals and all this stuff. So yeah, those things are not necessary for health. And in more often than not, they may, especially if you have any kind of metabolic issue, they might exacerbate that. So,
Well, Michelle, we were just so grateful for you that you would come on the show and help us, you know, kind of talk about these things, because this seems to happen, you know, every few months where there's a new headline, you know, keto's ranked 40 out of 40 for diets that you can do based on expert opinion. And there's like diets on there that haven't even been like mentioned for like 40 years. Like it's just such bullshit. And the problem is it's not just bullshit that is not true. And it's like, quietly, like not making a big deal. This has real impacts on people. And it is so important. I agree with you to look at this as a business decision, look at it as a complete industry. And what is the best way for them to make money? If you eat frequently, you will buy more food. If you're hungry, you are going to eat more frequently. You're going to eat things that sound good. And these foods are engineered to be maximally, you know, tasty, salty, crispy, crunchy, like the best foods. And people just, they have no choice. And yet they'll sit there and say, well, oh, keto's stupid. It's like, come on. So I'm so grateful for you to take a deep dive into some of these things. And just for the listener, like this, people want your money. They want to take your money, and you really have to be critical about this. And the health of you and your family and loved ones depends on you making some really critical decisions. Like you said, Michelle, I thought that was so important. Like, use common sense. How do you feel? What makes you more hungry or less hungry? Do you need to go to the doctor every month, or do you just feel good and go out and enjoy your life? Like, those things are so important to really think about. Yeah. People just see the headline and get scared and say, oh, I knew keto was a fad. I knew it. Go back to what they're doing.
I would wrap it up by saying, yeah, if you're someone who you feel like you need to eat every few hours, lest you have a emotional or a physical breakdown, or you feel dizzy or shaky, that's not normal. If you're going to the doctor every few months with a sinus infection or asthma or allergies, that's not normal. If you have severe cystic acne, if you have major anxiety, if you can't sleep at night, these things are not normal. You know, and unfortunately, we're not, as you know, doctors and even dietitians, we're not talking about how switching to lower carb and animal base can really shift your life and shift your health. And so, you know, take a minute. I hope people listening to this will take a step back and say, like, wow, you know, maybe you do struggle with these things. And it's also like, you know, I don't have kids, so my non-existent kids are perfect, right? But, you know, you get to decide what's in your house. You know, you don't have to have a bunch of sugary junk and nonsense in your house. You can, you know, stock your house with things that are healthy and good for you. You don't have to treat yourself with ice cream and cookies. You can go for a walk. You can get a massage. You can go to the park, you know. I often worry that we're letting foods and processed foods just kind of take over our life, our celebrations, our sadnesses, our every day. So I also just encourage people just to kind of think about where you're at and think about how you use food.
So I hope that conversation can help you be a little bit more wise next time you see these headlines and you start to see some of these arguments being made. They're based on assumptions, saying things like fruits and vegetables are good for everybody, and so if you eat less of them, it's bad for you, without having any kind of citation or a really well-done, vigorous trial done that shows that, or comparing two diets side by side where they say one is low carbohydrate and the other one is not, but they show the one that's not has better results when the low carbohydrate could be like 40% carbohydrate. It's just lower than the baseline of what most people eat. Like, you really need to pay attention to these details and really watch out for some of those key words. This may do this. This associates with this. We think this. Expert opinion, such and such doctor says keto is bad for you. Like, you have to pay attention for that because that's what gets all the headlines, and it's not based on science. It's not done with rigorous scientific detail. The way you heard David Harper talk very carefully about the research he does, the way you hear, you know, Dr. Ben Bickman talk very carefully about what he knows and what he doesn't know is very different than this whole world, which is, you know, again, grabbing all the attention and convincing people that this way of eating is not great for you. So at this point in the conversation, I think you've heard several times that following this type of diet is totally safe if you wanted to do this for the rest of your life. There is no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. Let me repeat, there is no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. You heard Nicole Laurent say the same thing. You need carbohydrate in the body, in the blood in particular, and other places in the body. But that does not mean you have to eat it for it to be there. Your body can make it extremely efficiently through a process of gluconeogenesis, which we learned about earlier. You do not need to consume any carbohydrates for the rest of your life. You would live a long and productive life if you chose to do that. That said, that doesn't mean that everybody all the time has to be on a ketogenic diet. They have to keep their carbohydrates extremely, extremely low. What a lot of people learn by eating this way is their body almost goes through a kind of reset, where since they were consuming so many carbohydrates for so long, the body was really unable to burn fat as a fuel source. And carbohydrate spikes insulin, and insulin keeps fat cells trapped and makes them really, like Dr. Ben Bickman says in our full interview on episode 30, really miserly. He wants, you know, like he thinks of the cells as like holding on to all this energy and really hoarding the energy. Once people kind of reset that with a low carbohydrate diet, some people find that they are totally comfortable and they want to continue life on that path. Other people find they can be quite successful by mixing in some safe carbohydrates as long as they don't go back to eating the way they were before. And so I really wanted to include this clip where Rachel is going to explain a little bit about what is metabolic flexibility. Her podcast is fantastic, called MetFlex and Chill. Rachel Gregory does a great job explaining this. She is somebody who is definitely in the low carbohydrate and ketogenic space for a very long time, has now decided to move past that, and helps her clients with reintegrating other carbohydrates in people's diets, things like fruits, could be rice, could be, you know, potatoes or whatever else, and people seem to be handling that quite well. So we just wanted to give an alternative explanation to this, explain metabolic flexibility, and explain her side of things as an alternate way that you can get back on some carbohydrates as long as you're careful and really honest with yourself about how you're feeling. This might be a good place to really explain what metabolic flexibility is and why that should be the end goal for most people.
Yeah, great question. So with metabolic flexibility, it's basically your body's ability to use the primary fuel sources efficiently and effectively. So when we're talking about primary fuel sources, we're talking about carbohydrates in the form of glucose, right? And fat in the form of fatty acids and ketones. Those are kind of our two primary fuel sources when we're talking about calories and fuel. Protein is there, but protein is not, we don't really want to use protein as a fuel source. We want to use it as a recovery resource. All of the processes in our bodies, there's a lot of processes in our bodies that require protein. So it's more of, I like to look at it as kind of that the building blocks, that the recovery side of things, building muscle, right? Muscle protein synthesis, all that jazz. But in terms of energy, like using energy, we want to use carbs and fats. And so in terms of metabolic flexibility, I kind of look at it on a spectrum. There's people who are, you know, very high carb. We call them, you know, sugar burners, or you use that term where you're a sugar burner, which basically you're kind of running off sugar, glucose all the time. Your body is not very efficient at tapping into its body fat to be used for fuel. So, you know, sometimes I like to reframe the way I say that though, because it can get a little bit like people can take it literally, in the sense of like, oh, I, you know, if I'm a sugar burner, I'm never going to burn body fat. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that it's harder for you to tap in to using fat as fuel if you're so accustomed to burning sugar, burning carbohydrates as fuel, versus someone who maybe have gone into a state of ketosis before, which is, you know, not your average American, right? Their body is more primed to use fat as fuel because their body can recognize that source. They can recognize the ketones, right? Most people in kind of the general, like if we're talking general American diet, standard American diet, they haven't used ketones for fuel since they were a baby.
Babies,
right?
Yep.
Yeah. So we've kind of gotten away from that kind of primal side of things, right? Just living in our modern world. And so going through a period of ketosis, really just kind of maybe going through maybe you don't even have to follow a ketogenic diet. Maybe you just implement some fasting here and there, or maybe you go into a little bit of a lower carb diet, and you just kind of try those things out. That can basically prime your body to recognize fat and ketones as a fuel source so that you can efficiently kind of go back and forth and use those things when it's warranted. So, you know, if you're sitting at your desk all day and you're just doing low activity, literally sitting at your desk doing nothing, working on your computer, you should be using fat and ketones as your primary fuel source, right? If you are out, you know, sprinting or you're in the gym lifting weights, like carbohydrates and glucose, that's probably going to be the primary fuel source that you want to use, right? But if your body's not efficient at going back and forth between those or tapping into those, right, from both sides of the spectrum, then it's just harder to be efficient at that. It's going to cause issues down the line, whether that's, there's so many different things that I can cause, right? So that's where the metabolic flexibility side comes into it, because we have people who are sugar burners, like on way on that side of the spectrum. And then we have people who are actually way on the side of the spectrum of fat burners, where they've gone keto, but they've stayed there for like a long time. And so their body has basically down-regulated the machinery to process carbohydrates efficiently, whether that's from just digestive enzymes or just not being used to them and things like that. So that's where the metabolic flexibility side of things comes in, because that's where you can kind of be in the middle and still kind of train your body to use these different fuel sources, but do it in a way that it recognizes them at different times when it's warranted. So that's kind of the gist of metabolic flexibility, just being able to efficiently switch back and forth between them at the specific times that they should be used.
Very well explained. Yeah, I love that. I'm kind of coming up with an analogy. Maybe this will be a little bit rough, so maybe you can help refine this. We have, let's say, two engines that can operate in our body. One is our race car engine, which is terribly inefficient. It's not trying to be efficient. It puts out a lot of pollution, does a lot of damage. You shouldn't really throttle it all the time. It goes through fuel like crazy, so you have to, you know, bring it into the pit stops to fuel it up all the time. You also have a hybrid car, so this is much more efficient. It goes way further. You don't need to refuel it very often, doesn't put out a lot of pollution, and you should be able to alternate between those two engines using them depending on what's going on. If we're Netflixing and chilling and we're watching Formula One on Netflix or whatever, yeah. We want to be burning fat even though we're watching the race cars go super fast and burn the other fuel. The problem becomes when we change our environment and now all we do is eat the kind of fuel that feeds the race car type engine, we stop being good at using the hybrid car type engine. And so now people are throttling the engine that shouldn't be throttled all the time. They're eating all the time. They're stimulating insulin all the time, gaining tons of fat, and not able to use that fuel source. So in my mind, a ketogenic diet is, okay, let's shut down at least temporarily the race car. Let's get the hybrid car to be really good. But if you just do that for so long, you won't be good at the race car stuff when you need to go on a race, which happens. Is that fair? How would you refine that?
Yeah. I mean, that definitely breaks it down. I would say that's pretty accurate. I think one thing I would say though, is that some people will, and I did this for a while too, like will kind of say like, oh, well, if I don't, you know, if I'm with carbohydrates, for example, and sugar, if it's causing all this kind of pollution, like you mentioned, or people will say inflammation, right? Then why would I ever want to go there, right? But I think, again, it comes back to what, like the specific goal that you have. And also comes back to the foods that you're eating too, because this is something that I think a lot of people get a little confused, is that when someone refers to processed foods or packaged foods or, you know, candy and things like that, people immediately think that that's all carbohydrates or, and sugar. And yeah, it is. There's a lot of sugar and carbohydrates in there too, but there is also fat in there too. So it's those two things combined in the process and that side of things is something that we also need to understand too. Because again, when we're going back to the strawberries and the sweet potatoes and the whole foods, those are things that, you know, will have a different effect in your body if you're having, you know, a sweet potato versus a bowl of pasta or, you know, some bread, like Wonder Bread. They have different effects in your body based off of the nutrients you're absorbing, based off the fiber, all of that. So that's also things that we need to think about, just like kind of the quality of the food as well.
Yeah, that's really well explained too. So how would somebody know that, you know, low carb ketogenic diet is still working and you can keep going versus like maybe you've done it a little bit too long and now we need to think about getting you off of it and transitioning onto something different?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it does come down to really just kind of taking a step back and realizing like, okay, what I'm doing now, is it working for me? Do I have specific goals that I'm working towards? And am I getting closer to those goals, whether that be body composition goals, performance goals, overall health goals? So it's really just kind of figuring out like, where am I at right now? And being really realistic with yourself or having someone come in from the outside and help you to take the blinders off and do a little bit of an audit of your overall goals and things that you're looking to get, you know, closer to, right? So that's the first thing, is just realizing that and saying, hey, am I at where I want to be at? Or could I be changing some things up to get to where I want to be? And so I think with people who are following a lower carb ketogenic diet, you know, if you've gotten to a place where maybe body composition changes are your main goal, maybe you've gotten, you're like, I've been doing keto for a while. Initially I had some really like good results. I was losing body fat. Maybe even, you know, getting into the gym a little bit more, feeling better. And then it kind of plateaued, you got stagnant, and you've just been there for a while and you're looking to continue to change your body composition. That might require bringing carbs back in, depending on what you're doing, depending on what your activity is like, what your main goal is in terms of being in the gym, how, you know, what type of lifting you're doing, what type of exercise you're doing and all that. So that's one standpoint. Performance standpoint, you know, are you trying to perform better in a sport or something like that? And you're not seeing any performance benefits anymore following a low carb diet. That's something to think about. From a general, like, at least for what I've seen with a lot of females, from like a general hormonal and even just like anxiety standpoint, sometimes, you know, bringing carbs back in can actually benefit those things, just overall. And I think, again, there's a few different things within that. There's lots of things within that actually, but the biggest thing is just being realistic with where you're at and kind of having that audit of what's going on, where you're at with your goals and, you know, not being afraid to try something different.
So we did want to include that clip there of Rachel Gregory. If you're curious about how to do that in a way that works out for a lot of people, I don't disagree with that. I think that would work just fine. Go back and check out our referral episode. We interviewed Rachel on episode 297 of Boundless Body Radio. I thought it was a really great conversation, and I certainly don't think that people would have a big problem mixing in carbohydrates if they do it in a smart way and in a really safe way. My opinion on what she was commenting on about being really poor about, you know, burning carbohydrates if you're only eating fats and proteins, I agree with that, but I also think that based on what I've learned from other people, especially people like Dr. Ben Bickman, there may be a very temporary amount of time that you are not burning carbohydrates well, but I think that with most of our life and lifestyles being so carbohydrate slanted for so long, I think that maybe after a meal or two meals of re-including carbohydrates, I think the body could very easily shift into a position where it would be very good at burning carbohydrates. So I prefer to stay a little bit more on the strict side with all of this. Learning about all of this stuff has really led me down the carnivore path, which my wife and I largely follow to this day. And I've been doing it for 3.5 years. And I've just learned, like, I really like the idea of being moderate with certain things, especially like desserts and sugar and other, you know, treats and things like that. And there's been times in the last few years where I have included more fruit. I have been a little bit more liberal with things like having a pie on a holiday or things like that. And I just find that I don't feel good. I get really anxious. I don't feel like my brain works properly. I feel like I don't sleep nearly as well. And so I do think that some people can be moderate. Some people can follow this metabolic flexibility style. They can reintroduce carbohydrates and they can be fine. And they can do that for the rest of their life, as long as they don't go back to eating, you know, the pure shit that they were eating before. But I also have seen where people start down that path. They start reintroducing carbohydrates and that completely derails them. And where they've worked so hard to get out sweet foods and you know, some of these ultra palatable and delicious foods, that's a lot of work to get out of the diet. And I've seen that they start with, you know, honey and fruit, and all of a sudden the palate changes back to where it was before, and they start eating all the crap that they were eating before they found the ketogenic diet. I've seen people gain a lot of weight back. I think by and large with a ketogenic diet, it's much harder to regain weight, but that is a way that some people do it. So I would ask you just to really think critically about you and your own personality and know whether you can be moderate or not. And some people, I think they need to be abstinent. I think some people can do party drugs on a weekend and they can get back to work on Monday and be just fine. And I think other people will have addictive reactions to that. And food is certainly seeming to be exactly like some of these drugs that we're talking about, these party drugs that people get very addicted to and can cause a lot of problems. I know that about myself. And so for me, it's not worth feeling terrible. It's not worth the anxiety. I stay, you know, very low carbohydrate. I include very few carbohydrates in my diet and I just feel better for it. So again, you can think about how you want to manage that. This has been such a fun journey going through all these different clips. This is a lot of work to put all of this together, as you can imagine, but it gives me an opportunity to re-listen to all of these wonderful people, these people that are very thoughtful and careful about how they're conducting their research, how they're talking about things, how they're writing about things. You know, I never set out to, you know, investigate ketogenic and low carbohydrate diets. I'm a nutrition coach. I'm a personal trainer. I'm not a researcher. I don't have a college degree. I'm not a dietitian. I shouldn't be as fascinated with this one topic as I am. And as I've started to learn about this and I started to find this world of ketogenic diets and really start to apply it in my own life and see, like Nicole said earlier, the magic that these ketones can do inside our bodies, it's been wonderful. And it's created this absolute obsession in my own life, which has driven our business, which has driven this podcast. And I just love learning about this because it seems like there's so many ways that this can help people. And I notice that people start to lose weight and feel great. They never really get all that hungry. You heard today all the different conditions that people can improve on when they're consuming a ketogenic diet and keeping their carbohydrates very low. I think it is not as difficult as people say, and I think it's something that people can adapt to very well. And it really has been the only way that I can get somebody to lose fat, you know, in an easy way without being overly hungry and feeling like their brain quality is improving, their brain fog is going away. Energy is going up. Sleep is improving. There's just so many different benefits. So again, it's been such a wonderful journey and I really appreciate all the people that have contributed to my knowledge and I can't thank all of our guests enough to be able to do that. And be looking forward to the next episodes. We're going to stay with the theme of ketosis. And like I said in the introduction, we are going to shift now from more of the science to a little bit less of the science and more of the personal anecdote and also tips and tricks on how to do this yourself. There's a really good way to do this and there are really bad ways to do this. And I think over the years of helping people with this and hearing everybody else's stories, we've gotten a lot more efficient on ways to make this easy for people, ways to make the transition really simple for people, and also ways to get past things like weight loss stalls and things like that. So we will be going in the next at least two episodes deeper into those stories. We're going to hear from people in the real world. We're going to hear from practitioners, people in the medical industry also. So be looking forward to that. Thank you as always for supporting us here through Patreon. We really appreciate you. And thank you for listening to the Balance Body Radio premium podcast all about ketosis. Thank you so very much for listening to this special episode taken from the Boundless Body Radio premium podcast. If you haven't already, please follow our show on Apple Podcasts and be sure to leave us a rating and review on that platform as it is the best way to continue to get our message out to new people all over the world. And as we said in the introduction, feel free to book a 30-minute complimentary session with us on our website at myboundlessbody.com so we can discuss your health and fitness goals and help you come up with a plan. Thank you so very much, as always, for listening to Boundless Body Radio.